The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thank you for joining me tonight. Girls, Inc. was founded back in 1864, just about the time the Civil War was coming to an end. And this evening, you'll be hearing from their president and CEO, Judy Vredenburg, who will tell us about some of the challenges that girls face today.
So unfortunately today, there is still a huge amount of bias, limitations, even objectification of girls that makes it possible for them not to achieve their full potential. Especially this is true for girls living in poverty and girls of color. They experience even greater inequities. The consequences for them are magnified.
And then I'll be joined by Aaron Ain, the CEO of Cronus and author of Work Inspired, How to Build an Organization Where Everyone Loves to Work. He cautions leaders not to become too disconnected from the people who work at the organization.
They get too wrapped around who they are and too wrapped around their title and their position. And they don't understand that by continuing to stay connected to people on their team, continue to stay connected to the organization, and treat everyone as almost they're an equal to you in these important ways, that you can get better results.
And for tonight's Better Than Most Corporate Culture segment, we'll be going to the Washington, D.C. headquarters of the American Red Cross. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, December 9th. There's a new app where with just a picture of your fingernail, it can tell you whether you have anemia. The simple tool could help health workers make faster decisions in developing countries. A few big gifts to report on. Bloomberg Philanthropies has announced a three-year, $50 million commitment in support of efforts to address the opioid epidemic in the United States. Biopharmaceutical company AbbVie has announced a $50 million gift to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in support of family-oriented, treatment-free space on the hospital's Memphis campus. And the LEGO Foundation announced that it is awarding a $100 million grant to Sesame Workshop to ensure that young children affected by the Rohingya and Syrian crises have opportunities to learn through play and develop the skills needed for the future. According to the most recent data that tracks walkathon-style events, revenue for the 30 biggest such events is down 6.7% overall since 2016, and participation is down 14%. And what is the best city for philanthropy? The winner in a poll conducted by the Chronicle of Philanthropy is Tulsa, Oklahoma. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Judy Vredenburg right after this.
Most teachers spend over $500 of their own money every year on school supplies because classrooms lack books, art supplies, even pencils. At DonorsChoose.org, you can help schools get the resources they need most. Bring a classroom dream to life. Visit DonorsChoose.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from the Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
When I hear the words inspiring all girls to be strong, smart, and bold, I know right away we're talking about Girls, Inc. And although a legacy institution, they have continuously changed and evolved to remain relevant to the girls of the current day. And we're delighted to have with us this evening the president and CEO of Girls, Inc., Judy Vredenburg. Good evening, Judy, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening.
Share with us, Judy, some of the history of Girls, Inc., an organization that was founded, my goodness, when the Civil War was still going on.
Yes, Girls, Inc. is both an enduring part of American history and our culture, as well as being modern and cutting edge. We're proud of those two facets of who we are. We were founded in 1864, 154 years ago.
Wow.
To serve girls and young women who were experiencing upheaval in the aftermath of the Civil War. Over time, we have adapted to meet the specific environmental challenges facing girls. I'm really proud of that, how we've been flexible, but of course we stay true to our deeply held values and principles.
Where do you operate, Judy, and what's the relationship you have with your chapters?
Yes, we have 81 separate affiliates.
Mm-hmm.
They're all separately governed, if you will. That makes us truly part of the community. We're grassroots. We're of and for the girls and their families in the neighborhoods in which they live.
And how does this work for a girl? I mean, how do girls find you? How do you find girls? Who's eligible for the program, and how long does it usually go on for?
Yeah, we target girls who don't have access to resources and opportunities. So we deliberately, intentionally work in neighborhoods, in partnerships with schools that are under-resourced. We target girls growing up in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And so through our 81 separate affiliates, we have centers and schools, and we've become really well known in those communities. So we don't have a problem with the supply side, if you will, girls and their families coming to us. We have capacity opportunities to raise more funds in order to reach more girls.
Mm-hmm.
So in general, we partner with schools. We serve girls in those schools as well as bring girls from schools to our centers.
Judy, what's it like to be a girl in America today? Now, I realize that every girl in every circumstance is unique, but are there some common challenges and pressures that girls typically face?
Yes. Unfortunately, we still have our culture that undermines, too often undermines girls' potential. In fact, we believe that we systematically shut girls out of opportunities to grow, to achieve, to lead. As Warren Buffett famously said when asked, why has he done so well? He said, well, I only had to compete against 50% of the population. So unfortunately today, there is still a huge amount of bias, limitations, even objectification of girls that makes it possible for them not to achieve their full potential. Especially this is true for girls living in poverty and girls of color. They experience even greater inequities. The consequences for them are magnified.
Yeah. Well, there are three elements that are critical for you to produce successful outcomes for these girls. And the first is people, and specifically mentors. Tell us about those relationships.
Those relationships are central to the change that we try to create with and for the girls. We are deliberately hiring staff who we trained who come from the communities of the girls that we serve.
Mm-hmm.
But they have been able to move themselves out of poverty through education and through a development of life skills. And so those girls are phenomenally relatable to our girls. They look like them.
Mm-hmm.
They can understand and empathize from where they're coming from, but they provide so much hope and so much the idea of possibilities, expand their minds about what could be because they themselves have undergraduate degrees, college degrees, often master's degrees. And so they build these very reciprocal, long-lasting, high-quality mentoring relationships. And the mentors who are trained professionals are so excited to bring in volunteers who can also expand the girls' ideas of what could be for them. And so we augment the mentoring relationships with a professional and add volunteers who come out of different employment sectors so that girls can see what could be for them.
Well, you know a thing or two about mentoring. You were the CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters, and I read recently that I think the CEO of Lord & Taylor really has pointed to you as being her mentor and how much it meant to her career. What makes for a quality mentoring relationship?
The most important thing is the reciprocity of that relationship, that it's two ways, that each party is benefiting from that relationship. Anybody who wants to be a successful mentor can't come in with the idea that you're going to impose your idea of the way that younger person should be. You have to actually do a really good job of listening, valuing the whole person, helping her figure out her strengths, decide her own or his own goals, and then provide the kind of confidence and support that and guidance that can enable that person to soar.
Yeah, it sounds like you have to enter that with the belief that they have the answer inside themselves, and you are not going to be able to provide the answer for them.
That is perfectly said, Denver. In fact, we come from the point of view that every single human being has strengths inside of him or herself. And too often they get messages that are the opposite of that. So we have to intentionally counter those messages and say, yes, you are worthy. You have strengths. You have to discover them. And develop them and let them rip and go with your strengths.
Gotcha.
Too often we think of our weaknesses and work hard to try to fix ourselves. And we can in an incremental, tiny, marginal way. But if we really understand our strengths and let them go, we can achieve our goals.
For sure. Well, the second thing is you pay a lot of attention to and are very conscious of the environment. What kind of environment do you try to create for these girls?
Yes. So we know that the individual mentoring relationships is key. But girls are growing up in environments that send oftentimes limiting, negative, objectifying, and even sexualizing messages. So we have to counter that intentionally. And so we create messages of affirmation, of positivity, of high expectations for the girls, mutual respect, treating girls with dignity, and believing that anything is possible that they set out to achieve. And so those messages in on the walls in our centers or in the classrooms where we come with girls, come together as a community, we are always reinforcing those positive messages. That's really, really important. It is about expectations that you have for yourself, that others communicate about you, that makes you start to think, oh, I guess I can do something. I guess I am important. This person doesn't have to say those things. They're not my parent. There's no obligation here. But in fact, they really truly do believe in me and see who, and that's mirrored back in how the person feels about herself. It's about changing your identity and you're building your confidence and your sense of self-efficacy, I guess I would say.
Yeah, who you can be.
Who you can be.
And who you are becoming. And these are all girls environments, right?
Yes. At Girls Inc., thank you. We only create all girls, pro-girls environments in order to deliberately edit out any messages that say that you would define yourself as strictly as the appeal you have to the opposite sex. In fact, we want girls to start to believe in their whole selves and, as I say, discover their strengths.
Yeah, and they sound like very safe environments.
Thank you. Yes. Physically safe for sure today. Unfortunately, we have to start with our physical safety. But for us, it's also really important to create that psychological and emotional safe place for girls.
And the final piece is research-based programming. Now, what does that consist of?
Yes, we are well known for the depth in which we go to understand how to create specific programming that is based on research, so that we can help girls develop the skills and knowledge that they need to navigate the world. So, for example, if we're doing economic or financial literacy programming, which we're well known for because we want to counter the stereotypes that girls can't be good in managing their economic futures, we would build that curriculum and make it age appropriate and make it based on research data that helps us understand how to teach the content. So the research is based on financial literacy content, but also girl development content. We spend a lot of time developing our curriculum and test it, learn also from the girls. It's not just the research based on the academic world, but also listening hard to girls, because how do we create the change? The research has to be related to how we create the change. So as I say, it's a, based in the content of the subject matter, but also the content of how the girls can learn and absorb the subject.
And speaking of that change, you also measure and evaluate the outcomes of this program, right?
Yes, we do. So at Girls Inc., we know the experiences that creates the change for girls is that combination of the mentoring relationships, the safe pro-girl, high aspirations environment, and our research-based programming. And
a three-legged stool.
The three-legged stool, they all come together to create a strong, smart, and bold girl. And so we measure in these three domain areas how well are girls doing in living healthy lives. Mm-hmm. It starts with our health, physical and mental health. And then how well are girls doing in academic achievement and academic attitudes. And then lastly, the bold part of our mission, which is probably what we're best known for, is the life skills instruction. So we measure how resilient are girls, how are they working in teams, how do they bounce back, how resilient are they in the face of adversity. We do these surveys for girls. We see that Girls Inc. girls are doing really, really well in terms of how they feel about their bodies. Are they happy with their bodies? How do they feel about the idea of going to college and completing college? And we are seeing that Girls Inc. girls are doing really, really well in general. But we do see areas for improvement. And that's the idea of measuring the outcomes. What are we doing well? How do we continue to do that, reinforce that learning? And what areas can we improve? We've learned that there's a drop-off in physical activity, physical exercise, taking care of their bodies as girls are getting older.
Mm-hmm.
And Girls Inc. girls are not exercising as much as the CDC and we all think is the norm. And so we're working with our girls and with our chapters, our local affiliates, to make sure middle school and high school girls are exercising more. So the idea of measurement is to assure that we're achieving the outcomes that we want to achieve, that we say we're going to achieve for and with our girls.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about body image. I think the stats show that about 78% of girls don't have a good image of their own body. And a lot of that probably is caused by advertising. And you have been a real advocate for truth in advertising. And this crystallized, at least for me, with this effort you had with the MTA and some of the ads they have on subways and on buses. Tell us a little bit of the story behind that.
Yes. We were asked to talk about that and by people who are really proactive in helping to transform advertising to deliver positive messages of how that would reflect well on girls. And so we were really pleased to be engaged. This is media literacy is mm-hmm. a subject that we have deep and long knowledge about. And so we were really happy to go come out and say that we have to work to assure that the messages in advertising value the full range of human bodies and human beauty, if you will. We're thrilled to have a partnership with CVS mm-hmm. Corporation and their move to not doctor advertising. And that's the same messages around the MTA advertising. In fact, we are really thrilled that an organization like the MTA and like CVS are saying, we're not going to doctor and
airbrush.
Thank you. The word I'm thinking of, airbrush, but in fact, show real people in the range of the human beauty
mm-hmm.
And not have it defined in a very narrow, limiting way that is actually destructive for girls and women.
Speaking of CVS, tell us a little bit more about your corporate partners and the revenue model of Girls, Inc.
The revenue model of Girls, Inc. Well, let me first start with our corporate partners. We are just thrilled by the depth and longevity and range of corporate partners. One of our wonderful corporate partners is Benefit Cosmetics. Mm-hmm. They have come out with a campaign called Bold is Beautiful, which is exactly in keeping with our philosophy that beauty is defined by each individual. Each individual is beautiful in her own or his own right. And so I think Benefit Cosmetics says we use cosmetics to make who you are enhanced. Mm-hmm. And so we love their campaign, Bold is Beautiful. Other organizations, causes besides Girls, Inc. benefit, but we're a very significant beneficiary of their campaign, which is done in May. When you get an eyebrow waxing, 100% of the revenue goes to the Bold is Beautiful campaign. So look for out for it next May.
Yeah.
It will benefit Girls, Inc. Another example, a very different example, is our long-term partnership with Lockheed Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And now Lockheed Martin has a CEO as a woman,
yeah, that's right.
Marilyn Houston, who is amazing and just really oriented towards giving back and helping build the pipeline and bust the myth that girls cannot be rocket scientists. And in fact, Girls, Inc. girls have always go through Operation STEM, SMART programming, which is STEM programming, mm-hmm. science, math, and applied relevant technology. So given our strength in STEM programming for girls, given Lockheed Martin volunteers helping girls break their own myths that you can't wear a pretty necklace and be a rocket scientist, because you can if you want to. We love our relationship with Lockheed Martin, which is that wonderful combination of time, talent, and treasure. They give it to us at the national level. They give it to us at the local level. We have board leaders. We have amazing financial resources and wonderful volunteer role models for girls. I could go on. We have many fantastic corporate partnerships. And corporate partnerships are a huge part of our revenue model, both locally and nationally. But the largest growth strategy has to do with individual donors.
Yeah, I bet.
We call them champions for girls.
Mm-hmm.
We have champions for girls who give annual support to Girls, Inc. locally and nationally at a minimum of $1,000 a year, which many people can figure out how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we have opportunities to do that through monthly credit card transactions. But we also have many 5, 6, and even 7-figure annual donors who are amazing champions for girls. So we're so appreciative of that as part of our growth strategy at Girls, Inc. We are very fortunate. We have also family foundations, large philanthropic foundations who invest in Girls, Inc. We have a board of directors at the national level and at local levels who are extremely generous philanthropists. And so that combination of individuals, corporations, cause marketing partners, mm-hmm. as well as classic corporate foundations, philanthropic foundations, and we do get a tiny amount of government money.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like the kind of mix you have to have. You're very intentional and thoughtful, Judy, about the corporate culture of Girls, Inc. What are the things you do to make it a very special place to work?
Thank you for asking that question. I have a tremendous pride in how we work together at Girls, Inc. We have some values that we spell out. As a matter of fact, over here in our New York offices, we have them on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is collaboration. We feel very, very strongly that we want a collaborative, cross-functional, cross-hierarchical culture, that regardless of your position, you can benefit from giving and receiving from your colleagues. And so I think that is really essential part of our culture, that we walk the talk of believing that each individual has strengths, ways to contribute, and that's how we think about girls, and so we want to create places where people can bring their whole selves, their best selves to Girls Inc., and do that in a sense of cooperation, but even more deeply than cooperative spirit is truly collaborative spirit.
And collaborative for results.
Thank you. I am personally a results-driven operator. I did that in my for-profit life, and I think that I bring that to the nonprofit sector. I think that historically it's been a little bit ironic to me that organizations that are doing so much good don't necessarily think about using scarce resources, especially talent, really well to drive results. And so, yes, collaboration for results is the way we work at Girls Inc. We're really clear about our annual objectives. We're really clear about how our annual objectives connect to our longer term objectives. We measure both qualitatively and quantitatively, and we are very transparent and accountable around what we're achieving. But also, it matters how you work together to achieve those results.
Absolutely.
I have become more appreciative of processes as I've gotten more experience.
Yeah, it's very true. The best cultures really focus on the how, just not the what. Let me ask you one more thing about culture. I've been to maybe over 100 nonprofit organizations and talked to them about their culture. And the thing that people wrestle with more than anything else is diversity, equity, and inclusion. How does an organization get beyond the discussion change and setting up committees and really begin to reinvent and reimagine itself to address this?
Diversity, inclusion, and equity is deep at Girls Inc. Nearly 70% of the girls we serve identify themselves as girls of color.
Mm-hmm.
They come from low-income communities. About the same percent come from families that earn $30,000 or less. So this is deep in the DNA of Girls Inc., the appreciation of difference, the celebration of difference, whether it's the range of gender identity, whatever the subject of difference is, that is a long-time value of Girls Inc. So what is fortunate for me coming in almost 9 years ago is that I inherited an organization that cared deeply about appreciating the strengths and celebrating the differences, if you will, among us and how we can collaborate and be stronger together as a sisterhood of support, including men, of course, but how we all can work together to collaborate for results. I am on the board of BoardSource, and I am really proud that we have made a decision that diversity, inclusion, and equity, both at Girls Inc. and at BoardSource, is something we have to work on. Certainly, as a society, we have a lot of work to do. At Girls Inc., yes, we have it written into our values. We train on it, both at the managerial supervisory level as well as within the organization. But I think in the end, it's how you reward and acknowledge the behavior that you want to reinforce. Culture does start at the top. And it matters how I behave and interacting with my colleagues and whether or not I'm going to be open to feedback about my own biases. We all have biases. And so figuring out how to continuously get feedback, become more aware of how we're being perceived, unintentionally being perceived by others within the organization, is essential to continuously making a culture that is inclusive and equitable.
I've heard from so many CEOs that the most insignificant and small things that they do can truly reverberate through the organization much larger than they ever imagined. Let me close with this, Judy. You announced that you will be retiring this coming April. Having been the president and CEO of Girls Inc. for about 9 years, what do you hope your legacy will have been?
I think that I have brought a performance orientation to Girls Inc. that we, as a culture now, are measuring, evaluating, and continuously learning so that we can improve. And coupling that, the performance orientation, with an external starting point, continuously understanding how we can be relevant to our girls, their families, to our donors, to our communities, to our partners, to our schools, mm-hmm. most importantly, means that we have to be starting outside in rather than inside out. I think those two changes in our culture, evolutions in our culture, keeping those strengths of believing in every girl's potential, the strengths of diversity, inclusion, and equity that I inherited, the strengths are powerful. What we've added, I think, is a real drive for measuring and for learning. We have always had a strength, actually, in training and mm-hmm. developing people. But using data to inform our decision-making, to constantly improve, is a legacy I know will continue because it's now truly embedded in the organization.
In the DNA.
And also being externally oriented so we continually are relevant to the girls and the communities.
Those are great insights. The answers are always outside your walls, not inside of them. Well, Judy Vredenburg, the president and CEO of Girls Inc., I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and how listeners can both support and become involved with your work.
Yes, please go to girlsinc.org. And we have this exciting new campaign, very, very important campaign. It's called #Girls2RespectStartsYoung. In the context of the Me Too movement and the huge issue facing girls and women of sexual harassment and even sexual abuse, sexual violence, did you know that 1 in 4 girls before the age of 18 is sexually assaulted? In fact, 7 out of 10 girls don't leave high school without having been sexually harassed. We have a huge, rampant epidemic that starts very, very young. So we at Girls Inc. have an obligation to be on the prevention side. We are starting a campaign that focuses on awareness first, and then what steps we can all take to improve the culture so that every person, every girl, every boy is treated with respect, is valued, and dignified. Please go to our website and join the campaign, Girls Too, Respect Starts Young. We ask you to take the pledge. You'll see the steps you might take to improve the culture, to improve the society where every human being, every youth is respected. Unfortunately, too many girls are sexually harassed, sexually abused. 1 in 4 is sexually assaulted before the age of 18. We must change the culture. Girls Inc. is leading with so many others so that all young people have a chance to grow up strong, smart, and bold. Please join us. Girls Too, Respect Starts Young. Go to our website, girlsinc.org.
An exciting and important note to close on. Thanks so much, Judy, for being here. It was a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Learn more by visiting benetech.org. Follow The Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to The Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
We regularly feature some of the best workplaces in the nonprofit and social good sector on the program from both the CEO and employee perspective. But periodically, we turn to an expert for greater insight. And this evening, we're fortunate to have with us one of the very best. He is Aaron Ain, the CEO of Kronos, who is a multi-year recipient of Glassdoor's Top CEO Honor and the author of a great new book, Work Inspired, How to Build an Organization Where Everyone Loves to Work. Good evening, Aaron, and welcome back to The Business of Giving.
Hi, Denver. joyful for me to be with you.
Let's begin, Aaron, by having you tell us about Kronos and what the company does.
Sure. Thank you. Kronos is in its 41st year of business. We started with the basic idea to take an everyday business practice, being the time clock, and automate it. So today we have a software systems that help companies effectively manage their workforce. We start by keeping track of when people come and go to pay them accurately. We automate all that. We also schedule people so that the right person is in the right place at the right time at hospitals and retailers and manufacturers and police departments and fire departments, et cetera. We also do payroll and human resources and aspects of recruiting and compensation and performance management. So this whole world of helping the human element of companies effectively manage those team members.
Becoming increasingly important. Well, corporate culture means different things to different people. How do you define it, and what is the CEO's role in shaping it?
Well, first of all, the CEO's role is perhaps the single most important aspect of establishing a culture and driving the culture. If the CEO doesn't believe in an engaged in culture that drives performance, then it's not going to happen throughout the organization, or it's going to be more difficult. For us at Kronos, where we have a wonderfully successful, engaged environment, and I would say an inspired culture, what it means for us is where we trust each other, where we openly communicate with each other, where we're transparent with each other, where we collaborate with each other, where we support each other, where we also communicate to our 800 people managers that the privilege they have of leading people needs to be taken very seriously, and the impact that managers have on their team members is perhaps the single most important thing. So these are all important areas, and I don't think people talk about them enough. I think that some organizations and leaders view them as soft areas or soft skills. For me, they're as strategic as can be to our success.
Yeah, not a lot of them learned about it in business school and just don't know how to get their arms around it. But as you say, it is so central. The concept of leadership is changing, so much so that you have referred to it as an unleader. So how does an unleader behave and act?
Well, I believe that sometimes when people reach their leadership positions, the higher up they get, this tends to be more acute, they get too wrapped around who they are and too wrapped around their title and their position. And they don't understand that by continuing to stay connected to people on their team, continue to stay connected to the organization, and treat everyone as almost they're an equal to you in these important ways, that you can get better results. And I think when people understand that, they can be more effective. So I call it in the book an unleader. And it's not that you're giving up your responsibility. You're not. You're still assuming the responsibility and making difficult decisions, but it's not all about you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you became the CEO in 2005, as you mentioned before, the engagement scores were not all that high, and they have now gone off the charts. You talked about some of the things that were critical to that, such as transparency and trust and things of that nature. But what did you do to create those things and allow them to happen?
Great question. So the first thing we did was we started by asking our employees what they thought. I think a lot of organizations ask them what they think about the environment and the company and the culture and the practices, but I don't think all of them act on it. So we combined listening carefully with acting on it. So for example, we took all the results from a particular manager down to the individual manager level, said, here's what your team said. What are you going to do in the next 6 months before the next survey happens to improve? I don't care what it is right now. I care what it is 6 months from now.
Yeah.
And have conversations with the team. Why did I get rated this way? Why did we get rated this way? What can we do to improve? And that's what we did. So we asked, we focused, we acted, and the results have been magical.
Well, one of the things you talk about in the book in terms of a great work environment is kibitzing, which you happen to be very adept at. Talk a little bit about kibitzing and also some of the things that create a great workplace environment.
Look, when I walk around our corporate office with 1,500 people, 17 floors. Mm. I don't have my nose in my cell phone. I'm talking to people. I'm walking with people from the youngest interns to the most senior executives. And I'm asking them all the time when I'm riding up in the elevator, how you doing? How's your family? How's Kronos doing? They say, great. I go, how do you know it's doing great? And they tell me, and I learn about what's going on in the company, and I stay deeply connected. When I go have lunch, I go in the area where lunch is served for everyone, mm-hmm. where they buy their lunch. I go and stand on the same lines with everybody else, and I talk to them. And then I go sit with different people, and I talk about how they're doing and what's going on in the business. So I stay very connected to what's happening. When my mind is a little bit fried in a given day, I say, I need a half hour break. I'll go to a different floor in the building that I don't normally go to, and I'll just walk around and talk to people yeah. and see how they're doing. This gives me an opportunity to know what's happening, and it's so valuable and so important. And a lot of times I act on what I hear.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can almost hear you say that when you are fried and you do that, some energy just seems to come out of nowhere, and you get excited by things.
Right, how could it not be?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you mentioned...
I mean, you love the people, you want them to be happy, they tell you what's going on. The more they talk to you, the more you want to hear them.
Yeah, yeah. You talked about managers before and the central role they play in workplace culture, and you've really codified this in Courage to Lead leadership course, which is mandatory for all managers. What is communicated, Aaron, in that course?
Okay, good question. So I personally believe, and I believe this with all my heart, that being a great manager is really hard. It takes tremendous courage. Who likes to have difficult conversations with people, particularly when it's going to impact the person you're talking to in a negative way? And so what happens is sometimes people just don't do it, or they think being a manager is a spectator sport,
mm-hmm.
that it'll just happen on its own. And so what we did was we started by putting a program in place called Courage to Lead. And the management training program, the operative word for me isn't to lead, the operative word is courage,
mm-hmm.
because it takes remarkable courage to be a great leader. And we teach them over a multi-day period and over a multi-month period all the tools that we think it takes to be a great manager. And that's what our Courage to Lead program is about. Look, I believe very deeply that great companies are driven by great people.
Yep.
And if you're going to make a decision like we do to hire great people, then you better have a great culture and you better have great managers. Because the disadvantage of hiring great people is great people have choices.
Mm-hmm.
And if they come and work for you and it's not the kind of place that meets their expectations, because they're great, they will go work somewhere else. So our Courage to Lead program is meant to create great managers who can help us create a great environment to motivate and lead great people.
And another element you added to that back in 2016 is you launched your Management Effective Index, correct?
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I just think it's a matter of time before on Glassdoor, you're going to see managers rated. Do you think that day is coming?
I think it would be fantastic because we rate them.
Yeah.
We have all 800 people managers are rated from 1 to 800 by how their teams feel about them. And the people in the lowest group, we work with them to share with them the feedback so that they can get better. If they don't get better, then we have to move them into another position at the company.
Mm-hmm.
So why not? I mean, it works from that point of view. Look, why did we do this, I think, is really important, Denver. And we did this because even though we have wonderful training through Courage to Lead, how do we know that people took to it?
Yep.
How do we know that they got it?
Mm-hmm.
And so we started by doing the Courage to Lead training and then saying, oh, great, we trained everyone. Everything's perfect. And then we realized no matter how good the training was, some people weren't going to get it.
Mm-hmm. And you also,
so that's what led us to go do this.
Yeah, and you want continuous improvement. And if they don't have a feedback loop to give them that how they're doing, you won't get that continuous improvement. You know,
And some people think they're doing great and they don't know that they could do better.
So, you know, we talked about
this is a way to help them.
We discussed workforce management, and you have some 35,000 organizations, Aaron. Now, I know it's hard to generalize, but what are some of the most common problems you think they encounter when it comes to workplace culture?
Yeah, so I think that they have the problems we talked about, creating an environment where people are motivated and excited to come to work, where they're engaged, because engaged people, motivated people produce better products and deliver better service. Mm. And this happens whether it's in a commercial business that's a for-profit or whether it's a not-for-profit that's serving citizens or serving people in need. And so the same rules apply in terms of driving towards this engaged workforce. And once again, I don't think enough companies, organizations understand the value of it. And it's a challenge they have today, mm-hmm. particularly in a world today where knowledge workers, the unemployment from my perspective must be zero because yeah. everybody we hire today has another job.
Mm-hmm.
Who are having to take from other places. So we have to work hard to make sure we're creating an environment where people want to be in our organization.
Let me close with this, Aaron. The ideas that are professed in this book are really universal and are applicable to just about every organization. But I know that you devote a lot of your time to philanthropic and social causes, have a lot of clients in that arena as well. And I wondered if there was anything specific that you would advise to those kinds of organizations.
I think that the principles of driving an engaged workforce, whether it's a not-for-profit, philanthropic, service-based organization, even a small one, are as important, in some senses more important. Why is that? Because in a lot of cases, these not-for-profit, philanthropic organizations do not have the resources to pay people mm-hmm. what they might be able to get in the commercial sector. So you have to go do those other things really well. About creating an environment where people are excited and they want to be there. And so all these areas of over-communicating and trust and transparency and collaboration and giving them great people to work for and understanding the importance of that, I would suggest is more important in those environments than in a for-profit environment where you can pay people more money in many cases.
Yeah, and I would agree wholeheartedly and add one other thing, too, is that in a lot of these nonprofit organizations, they don't have a product. The people are the product. So it becomes even that much more important. Well, Aaron Ain, the CEO of Kronos, I want to thank you for being here this evening. The book, again, is Work Inspired, How to Build an Organization Where Everyone Loves to Work. If you're a manager or ever hope to be one, this is a wise investment in your career and your future. Thanks, Aaron. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And tonight, we'll be coming to you from our nation's capital and the headquarters of the American Red Cross. We're going to begin with Business of Giving fave Gail McGovern. They are president and CEO, and then you will hear from some of the other members of the team.
I have seen more people hire for expediency and then dig out of a personnel problem and wish they never did it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd much rather keep that job open until the right person comes in. And I don't necessarily look for someone who can do the job when they walk in. I know this sounds lame, but people don't do it. I look for smart and I look for nice. And if they have those two traits, you can pretty much teach somebody anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you may not be able to teach them to be a brain surgeon, but in business and in nonprofit, you can pretty much teach them just about anything. And there's nothing worse than hiring somebody who's really smart who isn't nice.
It's probably 8 years ago. We were just talking about town hall, and we're doing one of Gail's town halls. And the question was raised in terms of what do we do at the Red Cross? And that's sort of everybody. And crystal clear answer, and it's still sort of burned into my memory, is we bring hope. And I think that the culture here reflects that as well. That you have folks that are just so committed to whatever it is that we do, whether it's, you know, all the different lines of service, whether it's the blood side, disaster, whether it's all of our support units and administrative and financial, all those pieces, single mission is to bring hope. And that's what we do here. So that's what our culture reflects and the way we deal with each other. So I think that's really important.
Her motto is recognize, recognize, recognize. And she and our team created this amazing virtual awards show. And as you might know, the Red Cross is a pretty remote organization. We've got people all over. And you know, being a nonprofit, we don't have the money to bring in hordes of folks all the time. So getting creative, using technology, we had this video Skype meeting. We all had costumes, and we gave people awards. So it was a true-on award show. We will now make it an annual event. I rode high from that experience for probably 3 weeks.
And I think one of the things that makes me very proud to work here is I think everyone gets to touch the mission. So I'm in a role where I'm behind a computer all the time. And it might seem like I'm not able to physically touch the mission, but one of the things is that even my everyday work behind the computer, my leadership team and my team makes me feel like I'm very involved. A lot of the times one of the things is that they will ask about my opinion on a lot of things, even if I might not necessarily know what's going on. They will always ask for my input. They will always ask for my feedback, and that feeling of being included and belonging as part of this greater mission is extremely important to me, and I'm extremely proud to say that's one of the exciting things about the culture at the American Red Cross.
And she said, I need a way to spend my time. I need something to do with my thoughts, and helping others is what's going to help me heal. And I just thought that was amazing, and I think that's something that that you really find in no other organization. I think we have so many volunteers because people see on the ground exactly what we're doing during disasters. So many people who have been affected decide to pay it forward by volunteering, whether that's in the United States or around the world.
Everybody is donating their time, their talent, their money, and their blood. And that just, resonates with me, and even the smallest ways. I had a moment several months ago. It was in winter. It was a cold, rainy winter night here in D.C., and I was watching the 11 o'clock news, and on comes a report of a home fire, and there is the Red Cross volunteer with the vest, and I actually started to cry. It was a home fire, but it was a miserable evening. The last thing I would want to do was to be outside in the dark helping, a family dealing with such anguish, and I swell with pride.
What's fascinating here is that while we do spend a lot of time recognizing individuals, we recognize teams. And we do, whether it's at all levels of our organization, get together at an executive level or our national meetings, we do these things called mission moments. And in a mission moment, we highlight whether it's a preparedness activity or blood services, disaster services, where I work, and we look at what the team achieved and what we could not have achieved as individuals. And we really highlight, look at this and the impact on, and what I think about it all the time is when we talk about our Sound the Alarm campaign, and we talk about installing 100,000 smoke alarms over a two-week period in 1,000 different cities.
You look inward to your own personal experiences, and you reflect on your own stereotypes and understand how it's impacting your behavior. And I think it's one of the only diversity and inclusion courses, and I've had a pretty long HR career, that really kind of perfectly blends the introspection with the outward focus. So, you start to become much more aware of how your own, experiences and your own story is creating, how you show up in the world every day, let alone, how you show up at work.
Our doctor told us partway through that it was 50-50 whether she would end up making it. Every year, on that anniversary of that surgery, we think back to the 21 individuals who were able to donate blood, and because of their generosity, because of their contributions, because of their donations, my wife's here. My kids have a mother, I have a wife. We get to experience that entire life because 10 years ago, people who give to the Red Cross every day, who give to organizations like this, who help, who give of themselves, really made a tangible contribution to our life. So when we talk about why people stay, why people feel connected, that is exactly why I feel connected, because I can see the impact that people make when they give of themselves.
A couple of years ago, we revamped our building, and it's really got an open space feel now here in the DC office. So we have a lot of desks that are flexible seating, basically. So they're drop-in desks where people can go work if they just need a change of scenery, or if they're visiting, or if they're typically a remote worker and they're in the office. And so I think that really allows people to actually not just change their scenery, but also change the people they're sitting near every day. And I think it really opens up more conversations with people you normally don't work with on your team or even in your department.
That transparency up and down has been something that I've been here long enough to say it has not always been that way. And certainly within the last 10 years, that has been such a refreshing change. And the other point that I'd like to make is that I have learned over these years is the staff need support, but so does senior leadership. And we have such a wonderful group right now, and it is so easy to be supportive of them as they have been supportive of us.
We move a number of tomorrow's leaders from experience to experience, so they get a good vantage point. But the other thing, which was an unintended consequence, and it was great, is these smoke alarm campaigns. Hmm. You know, the one that I was recently on, we had people from our IT department, from legal, from finance, from, you know, areas that would never touch the mission that way, from our biomed business, from our health and safety business. And the next thing you know, people re-fell in love with the Red Cross. Hmm. You know, they're welcome into a stranger's home. They're helping them potentially save lives. They re-fell in love with the missions.
Me personally, one of the things that I've tried to do is build in time in those virtual meetings to have a stronger relationship. So for example, if I'm leading a big project team and we can't pull folks together face to face, I'm going to build some sort of team building activity virtually. So, you know, we're going to send something beforehand. So we're spending some time on the relational aspect. To me, my personal work experience is always enriched when I can have more authentic dialogue and have a stronger relationship with my team, even if it's virtual. So it's celebrating a holiday virtually. Like we have, an Indian colleague, and we celebrated Diwali. We had, you know, candies, and we ate, you know, we had virtual coffee and tea. And so just creating a space in those virtual experiences to build rapport and ensuring that it's a priority.
Our team has what we call a MODS day. Our team is along marketing operations, data sciences. We call it MODS. And we come in to either the DC office, the Fairfax chapter, or a local public library around the area once a month to bring our team together, to say, you need the face time that we've lost from being in a traditional office environment. How do we recapture that? How do we build up that camaraderie? How do we get to know one another? And at the same time, work collaboratively on efforts that are relevant to each of us. It helps us bring back some of those traditional elements, and it also helps us put into perspective what we're all working towards when we're all off in our own rooms, we're all off in our own offices, et cetera, trying to stay connected, trying to remain a part of that mission and stay connected as a team.
One thing that that has come out of this Engage survey is there are managers who have very great employee Engage scores. And one thing that HR actually did was they pulled together the employees, I mean the managers who had great Engage scores, and asked them, what are some best practices? And I think, you know, that document shows that, you know, communication, transparency is key. And, you know, the Red Cross is trying to learn from these amazing managers.
I think that people at the Red Cross tend to become really close with one another. And I would say many of them, if not most of them who you ask, their best friends work at the Red Cross. And I think a big reason for that is because
we are all working towards the same mission, whether there's a disaster or not, and we're doing that around the clock and in very close quarters often, right? So during domestic disasters, staff and volunteers often sleep in staff shelters. They are sleeping in very close quarters or even share hotel rooms. Around the world, we often have to sleep in tents if you're in an earthquake zone so that you're not sleeping in dangerous buildings, or in base camps where you're eating every meal together, you are working in the base camp together. You are spending sometimes 8 hours in a car together. So when you're in close quarters like that, you are working and you are talking and you are socializing, and you are, even when you're not talking, you are having some kind of really unique experience with your colleagues, with your coworkers, and with fellow volunteers.
I want to thank Elizabeth Penniman for organizing my visit, and to all those who participated in this piece: Mark Smith, Heather Peterson, Tony DePasquale, Naoku Okuma, Janelle Eli, and Sue Burns. To hear this again, read the transcript, or see pictures of the participants, just come to denver-frederick.com, and we'll provide a link there to my full interview with Gail McGovern, the president and CEO of the American Red Cross. And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.